is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Things are starting to pull back here as we end this pre-Easter weekend in the markets, everything from oil to commodities to actually stocks. Stocks a little bit mixed on this Thursday. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Gary Dorsch will be joining me. He has some interesting things to say about the oil market. Gary believes the Fed will be raising interest rates sooner than most people think. And he also thinks that there may be better days ahead to be buying gold. He will be joining me in the first hour, and Frank Holmes will also be joining me as we discuss the gold markets and especially the condition of gold stocks in the industry itself. A lot of interesting things to say there. Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. Since this is a holiday weekend, we're going to feature an interesting interview with William White, who is chair of the Economic Development Commission from the OECD in Paris. It'll be a little different type of big picture, but it's different for a holiday weekend. But first, Ryan Poplava. Well, it was a short week for you and the markets, Ryan. The markets were closed on Friday, and, well, maybe that was a boon because it seems there is some much-needed time to just step back and reflect on conditions and market drivers in order to decide how long this improved outlook on the economy and financial conditions are actually going to last. And it was quite interesting, too, as well, I would say, given the turn of events. It seems like conditions were ripe for the bears to redirect markets this week with a terrorist attack in Brussels and some very, very weak economic news, but it didn't seem like they really pressed very hard.
No, and John, you know, the worst thing I can think of when I turn on the TV for news daily is just seeing headlines that a major public venue has been bombed or just terrorized, and, you know, it's just tragic. But what was interesting is that on Tuesday, the response by the markets was rather subdued, given in such a tragic event. And, you know, we got to look at that. And the German DAX was down almost 2%, but recovered almost all of the decline by the end of the day. You know, despite, you know, we continue to get headlines and developments of the story. And it was, like I said, just tragic, but a chance that the bears had to really kind of swing control in their favor. It didn't happen. Volume was down. There's been this persistent overbought condition in the market. That's been for a week or so now. No, it was definitely a surprise to me that day that, you know, with such a terrible event, the financial markets obviously didn't interpret it economically as bad as it really was for many of the families there. But, you know, besides the terror attack, John, you pinpointed that there was some weak economic news, and that it definitely was. The drivers were available for the bulls to cash in and the bears to kind of renew their efforts from January. And there was some communication by the Fed officials that was, it seemed to me, attempting to prepare the markets for a hike in the near future. It definitely feels like they're trying to prepare the way. And that message seemed more hawkish than the one we heard from the FOMC just, you know, last week. And, you know, despite the dot plot's prediction of two hikes before year end, it feels like they're having to massage the market's interpretation more. And they definitely did that. You know, they added upward pressure on the dollar because of it. On top of that, bearish inventory data came out by the American Petroleum Institute, which we actually, you know, John, I've been saying, you know, we've been having this build in crude for weeks now. But, you know, everyone's just been focusing on, you know, more of what's going on in the finished product inventory data, you know, the distillates, the heating oils, et cetera, where those are being drawn down from this sort of delayed winter that many have experienced in the East. So on that day, on the news of that bearish inventory data, oil swung down 4.3% lower, and that was on Wednesday. So you have a strong dollar, weak oil, you know, John, those are the catalysts that have been persistently just hurting this market for a year now. So, you know, both a strong dollar and a weak oil price, you know, that definitely weighed on stocks this week. But like I said, it seemed rather subdued compared to what, you know, looking back in January, what it could have been.
Okay, well, Ryan, well, do me a favor. Tell me a little more about what you think the Fed officials were communicating this week, and really how we may need to shift the narrative with the new Fed speak that we seem to be witnessing.
So, yeah, there were about four of them. San Francisco's President Williams, the Chicago Fed President Evans, Philadelphia Fed President Harker, and St. Louis Fed President Bullard. You know, all four of them spoke at some point this week. The most dovish of that group is Evans. He leans particularly more in that dovish camp. A lot of his speeches are leaning on the dovish side. And he simply stated that two hikes this year were appropriate. So he very simply said, you know, the most dovish guy there said, I think there should be at least two hikes this year. So that, I think the market's kind of shifting this idea towards, well, that's the minimum. Maybe there's more. And that's where we hear from Williams and Bullard, who said that a rate hike in April is on the table. Well, then, like I said, you're kind of shifting sentiment a little bit from what we just heard last week, which was pretty much, it felt like from Yellen, like, we don't know. We don't know what's going on globally, and we don't know when the next rate hike is going to be. Here, we got a couple that are saying April's on the table. So, you know, there's a consensus that's being built at the Fed, and it seems like they're trying to shift it a little bit in the direction of two hikes is a minimum. Could be more. And conditions aren't so weak that the intended pause from January needs to go the full 6 months, as the market maybe is interpreting, until we get that next FOMC meeting with a conference call. You know, everyone expects that when rates are going to be hiked or whenever there's this policy change by the Fed, it has to be done on their quarterly little conference call meetings, which, like I said, every quarter they give. And so this idea that rates might be going up as soon as April, that helped move the dollar higher, which also weighed on commodity prices this week on top of that bearish oil inventory data. And, you know, that also means that the April 6th Fed minutes will likely have more influence than maybe we previously anticipated. Maybe we anticipated that the pause would go longer. You know, it's all data dependent. You know, things can change on a dime. Next week, I can give a total different message. But here's what we heard from the Fed officials this week. And, you know, it's just amazing to me, John, that the economics have improved, yes, but really, have they improved so much for these, you know, I would call them very studious officials in the School of Economics? Have they improved that much to justify higher rates yet? You know, we look at manufacturing still contracting. It's improved a little bit, but you look at the ISM manufacturing data, still contracting. It's in contraction territory. But it may be that they're looking at tighter job markets. Yes, you and I, John, we've been talking about the higher CPI data figures. The jobs numbers came back. They were above consensus for February. But, you know, even if the new jobs aren't as high paying as the ones that are dropping off in energy, I think it should discount a little bit some of that growth. And, you know, just as a sign that inflation expectations need to rise, you know, I know they're really focusing on labor in that regard. So, you know, is the shift in monetary policy, we're at pause right now. Has the economic shifted so much that we need to go back? I don't know necessarily. You know, we saw the durable goods orders this month for February. It was announced this week, and it was bad. It was below consensus, and the new orders portion was really ugly too. You know, and it appears that the Fed, maybe to me, cares less about manufacturing, which is, again, 14% of GDP. That's still a good chunk. And, you know, a lot of these multinationals, they're dealing with their exports with a strong dollar, having a hard time with that. And we've seen that in earnings. So a strong dollar definitely getting a little bit of a rise this week out of these comments.
Okay, well, the Fed has stated its concern about global markets, and it doesn't seem in the last few weeks the conditions have really reversed completely there. There's an interesting series of rumors that the central banks are getting more and more interested in coordinating with each other about keeping everything afloat, but those are rumors right now. Some of the European press had that today. Now, you put a lot of emphasis on the policy divergence gap narrowing as of late, so let's hope the Fed isn't in that much of a hurry to support that trade, you know, as as look as we're, it's got us, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So having said that, anyway, is there anything else this week our listeners should know about or maybe look forward to next week? And you're not scheduled to be with us next Friday, but at least you can help us look forward. We'll get the report from perhaps Jim or Chris, but I'm sure you're going to have some ideas to what they're going to be looking for.
Yeah. You know, it's always good to look ahead, see what's on the docket. And, you know, the one thing I mentioned, you know, if going back to concerns about global markets, we have been seeing a lot of QE tools being applied. Europe, big bazooka from them. We talked about that a few weeks ago. Japan as well, with their negative rates at the end of January. You know, China this week, John, announced that, and this was towards the end of the week, that they want to move forward with a tax cut plan. And we're hearing rumors as well from Japan that they want to come and put together some sort of fiscal package. Remember we talked about the G20 really didn't seem like we had a really a big game plan fiscally, you know, monetary policy. There's been so much done, like I mentioned, but we really haven't seen the fiscal side of things. And maybe we will. So definitely look for more information on that if and our listeners are tuned into those headlines. You know, that was very interesting to hear from China. Follow Chinese markets, follow the Chinese Shanghai Index. You know, did see a small double bottom there recently, technically, but we still haven't gotten through some long-term resistance levels. So that still is an area of concern for the markets, remember, in August. So, you know, given that Europe and Japan have negative interest rates, you know, governments have to do something now because it doesn't really feel like, you know, monetary policy. Draghi said, I think this is it. So, yeah, like I said, expect more on the fiscal side of things, we hope, to help the global outlook. But, you know, we'll get the March flash purchasing managers index numbers on Thursday and also some formal ones on Friday. But right around the corner is the earnings season, John, on April 11th. I won't be here next week to kind of warn our clients about that. Yeah, it's right around the corner. And, you know, as I've mentioned, we are in an earnings recession, and that's being supported by all of the monetary policy moves that we've seen recently, which has helped this from really unraveling. And, you know, it would be important for the U.S. narrative for earnings to improve. There's just no question. So a lot of focus needs to look more towards that area in the next couple of weeks.
Well, Ryan, I hope you have a good weekend. And when you get back, we'll look forward to hearing from you again.
Sounds good, John. Have a good week. Happy Easter.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Greetings, everybody. John Loeffler here. You know, as a Financial Sense insider, I am sure that you know by now that our weekend program isn't the only news and interview audio available from us right here at financialsense.com. We have a weekday program called FS Insider, which features a wide variety of in-depth interviews with key economic experts. And this is available only to subscribers to this service. So what I wanted to do is just take this brief moment to point out that the price for new subscribers to our premium channel will be going up shortly, but that if you're not already a subscriber, you can still get in at the lower subscription rates by going to our website, financialsense.com. You really don't want to miss this opportunity to hear key economic information, news, and views by becoming a subscriber to FS Insider, and do it before the rates go up. And just in case you wonder what you might be missing, here's a selection from one of the Insider programs this week.
Eric Haddock, the editor and publisher of Inside Track and Weekly Relay, joins us today. And Eric, we talked to you in 2006. You had said that you were looking at a peaking of the stock market then. We spoke to you again in 2014, and you said you saw a massive convergence of cycles taking place, with the likelihood of some crash cycles taking place in the late 2015-2016. We certainly saw that, and many of the things that you outlined certainly took place, including in 2014 when you spoke about a massive bull run in the dollar, which we did see. And you'd also been speaking for some time, I believe a matter of years, about 2016 being a golden year. So you've been making some very prescient calls based on your cycles work. So let's give our listeners a little bit of an outlook and an update with where you think things stand today. Today, I'd like to cover the stock market, gold, and also how you're looking at some potential food crises on the horizon as well. Given that you said that you were thinking we were going to see a major peak in the stock market in the 2015 timeframe. Where do you think things stand now? We have seen a large rally, like I said, of 13% since the bottom. Do you see this as just a bear market rally? Has this been convincing enough to change your outlook? What are your thoughts?
Well, I am looking at the overall market as being in a major transition. Like we talked about in late 2014, there were just these generational, multi-decade, multi-century cycles all coming to a head. And I was looking at the time frame of 2015, 2016, 2017 as being really the first phase of that transition, and a little bit bigger phase going into 2021, and then even stretching out beyond that. But that's, you know, kind of real broad-based. Honing that down a little bit, 2015, 2016, and even 2017 are what I correlated to crash cycles. And I defined that more specifically as being a 1 to 3 year drop of 35% or more in at least several key indices. And even within that time frame, one of the descriptions that I started discussing back in early 2015, and everything I've seen since then has just corroborated it and reinforced it each time, and that was that I suspected that this bear market would look a lot like what the Dow Industrials experienced between early 2000 and mid-2001. About a 15, almost 18 month period in which the industrials would see a sharp 1, 2, or 3 month sell off, retest some previous support, maybe spike below it a little bit. And just when the bears were feeling emboldened and everyone was yelling, the sky is falling, then it would turn around just very abruptly. And next thing you know, we'd see a 1 to 2 month rally that took the industrials almost back up to their previous high. And just as you got to that level, and all of a sudden the bulls were feeling their oats and talking about the next upside levels that were going to be seen in 6 to 12 months, the market would top and abruptly turn back down with almost the same ferocity that it had done at the bottom. And everything I've seen up to this point has just really confirmed that with some precision that I wasn't even expecting, like those things I was just describing. It's just been amazing to me how closely the Dow Industrials have mirrored what they did back in 2000 and 2001. And I see some reasons to expect that comparison to continue into mid-2016 and even into the second half of 2016.
Well, for investors, it keeps getting better, even though the markets are pulling back as we end this Easter weekend. It's been a good run since the middle of February. Joining us on the program is Gary Dorsch. And Gary, let's begin with the S&P. If you look at a chart, it looked like we had a nice double bottom late January, late February, and it's been straight up ever since. But what really strikes me this time around, Gary, it's not just that our markets are going up. We've seen emerging markets go up. We've seen junk bonds rally. We've seen commodities go up at the same time. So let's begin with the market. What's your take here? Is this a bear market rally? Or, as some technicians imply, maybe we're back to a bullish mode again?
Well, my best guess is we're going towards the upper end of a longer-term trading range, which has now been established for over a year. If you look at the S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials, since the Federal Reserve mothballed its QE program back in October of 2014, we're not too far from where the stock markets were on that day. That goes back almost a year and a half. Most recently, the stock market's movements have been moving in lockstep with the price of crude oil, and that still continues to this day. We've seen this correlation, very strong correlation, still intact for the last several months. The double bottom that you referred to in January and February for the Dow and the S&P was January 20th and February 11th. On those exact dates, the price of crude oil also made a double bottom at $26.50 a barrel. So the correlation was to the very day. And since February 11th, the price of crude oil has rebounded as much as $15 a barrel from $26.50 to $41.50. And as a result, the Dow Industrials rebounded by about 2,000 points, and the S&P moving up along with it. So there is a reason why oil prices and the stock market are so closely correlated, and that happens to do with the junk bond market, as you had referred to. One of the biggest threats to the economy, to the stock market, to the banking system is the price of crude oil at the moment, with about $300 billion of energy companies whose bonds are rated at junk levels at double B plus or less. Of the $300 billion in the junk bond sector is in the energy sector. And should the price of crude oil fall towards 30 or in the low 30s, it increases the odds of a significant amount of defaults in that area. In fact, a few weeks ago, the credit rating agency Fitch expects $40 billion of junk bonds to default this year nonetheless, even if oil stays under 40 a barrel. So with 30, you have the potential for even larger size of defaults, which in turn would hurt the bondholders. And a lot of banks, especially regional banks, have even syndicated loans that are not publicly traded over the counter, but are between the banks and the borrowers themselves, which could also go sour. And so we see a very high degree of correlation between oil prices and bank stocks as well, because it's all tied in with the price of oil and the potential for some of these loans to default. Many of these loans were given out and these bonds were sold at a time when oil was at 100 a barrel, and no one could have conceived that oil would have dropped into the 30 range, putting many of these companies at risk of default. An article I read said that the average break-even price for these shale oil companies is about $45 a barrel, and North Dakota Bakken shale oil trades roughly $2 to $3 a barrel less than the West Texas sweet that we normally see on the NYMEX. So there's still a very dangerous situation, but as long as oil prices are recovering, it reduces the fears of default, reduces the anxieties of default. And in fact, many speculators have jumped right back into junk bonds in recent weeks during this rally since February 11th. About $6 billion of fresh cash coming into the junk bonds via ETFs, locking in higher yields, and the hope that oil prices have bottomed out for the longer term and then that they will recover to more normal levels or what we're more historically used to seeing and reduce the threat of defaults, and they can enjoy these higher yields. And that's all correlated with the price of oil. So that is at the epicenter of what we're seeing. And in regards to the stock market, of course, the Fed's open mouth operations played a key role back in February when the price of crude oil was under 30 and the stock markets were under siege and under selling pressure. Several Fed officials began to send signals to the market that the upcoming rate hike for March, which had been widely telegraphed at the beginning of the year, would be delayed, perhaps for quite some time. That is how the Fed operates. When the markets are going down, the Fed begins to talk a little more dovish. And sure enough, now, without the fear of the Fed raising rates, that was also a positive factor for both the commodities and for the stock market, because if the Fed is not going to raise interest rates, the U.S. dollar could lose some of its value in the foreign exchange market. And as the dollar falls in value, it helps to increase the prices of globally traded commodities such as copper and such as gold and crude oil itself. So everything is pretty much working in synchronization. The Fed, playing a role with its open-mouth operations. And then the rally in crude oil is very interesting.
Hey, Gary, let me stop you there. When I talked to you last time, you were thinking that the Fed would be a lot more aggressive than it is. I mean, the markets right now are factoring in, including the Fed dot plot, that they only go twice this year. So the thinking is they'll go in June and maybe in December after the elections. Have you changed your views on that, or are you going along with what Yellen is telling the markets maybe two times this year?
I'm still in the opinion that the Fed will raise interest rates several times this year. And interestingly enough, I think Goldman Sachs on Monday predicted there'll be 3 to 4 rate hikes this year. And in the last 3 or 4 trading days, we've had 6 Federal Reserve officials, from Centrist to Doves to Hawks, all clearly saying that they are ready to raise rates at the upcoming April meeting, which that'll be around April 26. So what happened was the Fed, in its desire to manipulate markets, put out the revised dot plots last week, indicating that instead of the planned 4 rate hikes, there would only be 2. That was taken very favorably by commodities, gold, oil, stocks. And after the markets went up, the Fed said, we're going to reverse now that the stock market added another 500 or 600 points on the Dow. They started reversing their rhetoric. And in the last several days, from the Richmond Fed to the Philly Fed to the Chicago, the St. Louis Fed, the Atlanta Fed chairman, all saying that the market is ready for another rate hike. The economy can handle it. It's resilient enough. And so what we see is when the Dow gets above 17,000, the Fed starts to talk more hawkishly. And when it drops into the mid-15,000 range, it starts to talk more dovish and takes rate hikes off the table. So it is actually operating not strictly based economy data dependent, but market data dependent. Of course, that's not supposed to be part of their mandates, but that is how they are operating. So I do now believe the Fed will move to raise the Fed funds rate to a quarter point at the April 26 meeting. And in fact, now part of the reason the dollar has recovered and the price of gold has dropped about $50, $60 an ounce in the last several days is in reaction to this hawkish talk by these Fed governors. And I don't think they're going to reverse now. I think they will move forward with that. Overall, I do believe their goal is to try to raise the Fed funds rate and then therefore keep the Dow in this sideways trading range. They'll be very happy if it can retain the gains that it's had over the last 7 years without giving much up. It won't be risk-free. When they do raise rates, there'll always be some turmoil and fallout from any rate hike. But they will engineer it in such a way where they will wait for markets to recover and sentiment to become a little more bullish before leaning against the market rally, thereby keeping in a sideways range. And should the market drop after the rate hike, the Fed will simply wait for it to stabilize and recover. They've also got help from overseas as well with the negative interest rates, by the way, playing a big factor in all this.
Yeah. Is there a risk, though, given what the ECB has done with negative interest rates and more quantitative easing, that if the Fed should raise, then obviously the spreads between our debt and European debt get even wider? Isn't there a risk that we could see a much, much stronger dollar, which we know is impacting the manufacturing sector? It's impacting exports and also corporate profits on international companies, which make up the S&P.
Well, that is the risk, and most of the risk is from overseas, as you mentioned, with the via the strong dollar. Manufacturing accounting for about 12% of the U.S. GDP nowadays. But on the other hand, we see that housing prices are about 4.5% higher than a year ago, and we also see car sales booming at an all-time record rate of nearly 18 million annualized rate, and we see the labor market generating over 200,000 jobs a month. And we also see, most importantly, the core rate of inflation, subtracting out food and energy, up 2.3% compared with a year ago. And you know, the Fed says it targets 2% on its private inflation gauge. Overall, the core rate of inflation, which is itself a doctored figure, I'm sure it's higher than 2.3, but they're at least admitting that. That is pointing upward. And so, therefore, the Fed is justified in raising rates because it has to contain an inflation threat. Now that oil prices have probably hit rock bottom and are going to eventually go into the mid-40 range, the reason I say that is because looking at the December 2016 contract, that's priced at around 43 to 44. That's where traders expect oil to be by the end of the year. That threat is behind us. There could always be a pullback of a few dollars, but the oil-inspired decline in inflation is behind us now. Therefore, as the labor market continues to strengthen and unemployment falls, you know, the Fed is still enamored with the Phillips curve. In any event, that will persuade them, I believe, to raise rates to head off inflation in the service sector. So, yeah, they saw a court in a bind. They have to navigate through the weaker manufacturing side, but the threat of inflation on the core rate, rents, medical costs, other service-related costs are accelerating. And so they're going to try to maneuver the rates a little bit higher, as I see it. And that will keep the stock market in a sideways range. Still very accommodative. I mean, keep in mind, if you looked at a 50-year graph of the federal funds rate, to go from 0.375% to 0.625% is really minuscule. You need a microscope to see it. It's still highly, highly accommodative. And at the same time, the Fed has the outside support from the negative interest rates in the other economies. The money injections from Japan and Europe is fungible. And that could help to keep the bond yields down and then therefore prevent any real severe fallout from a slight tightening in monetary policy. Therefore, the only risk would be a stronger dollar, which could possibly depress the commodity prices. But commodity prices have been in a decline now for 4.5, almost 5 years. Markets do move in longer-term cycles. So I do think the cycle has hit its bottom trough for commodity prices. The other factor is demographic. When I think about commodities, the world's population is increasing rapidly. I believe it's expected to increase by about 1 billion persons over the next 10 years. That's a lot of demand. So it's not just all monetary factors that affects commodities. Eventually, the demand on a net basis of an increase in the world's population could kick in and support commodity prices as well. They should get moving up a little bit on trying to contain inflation with a slightly tighter monetary policy.
Let's move on, speaking of commodities, to the price of gold. We've had a real nice run-up beginning in February when Japan announced negative interest rates. What's your take on gold here, which has been pulling back recently?
Right. The combination of the negative interest rate in Japan was actually the trigger, and then Europe decided to put more fuel into the fire with increasing their monthly injections of QE by 20 billion euros a month. This time, not only is Europe buying sovereign bonds are also going to buy corporate bonds, which will help to put downward pressure on corporate bond yields in Europe. And when the Fed revised the dots plots, that was the final good piece of good news on this parabolic move upward. But in recent days, once again, the Fed is changing its tune and now threatening to raise rates. I believe this rate hike now will start to overhang the market for the next several weeks, the expectation of it between now and the April 26 meeting. Therefore, I would suspect that gold probably hit its peak on this move up. I had anticipated last time we spoke it could possibly get up to as high as the 1300 level, and it got to about 1280. And so looking at it technically, if there's a 50% pullback on this rally, it would find support around 1180, 1190, where buyers would come in. This, once again, you got counterbalancing forces, the possibility of a Fed rate hike, but also the negative interest rates overseas and the money injections overseas is a positive factor, as far as I see it. So at a lower level, there'll be buyers. And China also has resumed purchasing of gold. We should not forget that China and India are the world's two largest buyers of gold. India will be further cutting its interest rates based on expectations in the marketplace. And China has indicated that they will do more money injections if necessary. So I think they'll come in as buyers at the 1180, 1190 level.
Is that a level you feel safe to get back in?
I would for a longer-term investor. Of course, it's hard to pinpoint exactly in today's volatile markets, but if you could get a 50% pullback, I would be interested in adding or buying gold and holding over the longer term. That's based on my idea that we hit rock bottom a few months ago, and after a parabolic move, as it had, it's natural to see, you know, a pullback. And then after the Fed raises rates, quarter point, that might be the last one for quite some time, and then that threat is out of the way. Then we go back to focusing on money injections out of China and the rest of the world. So, yeah, I would think that would hold as a support area for longer-term buyers, and certainly you're buying it way off the highs from 2011.
Well, Gary, listen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, can you tell them how they could do so?
Well, I do have a website. I'm actually launching a new revised website that'll be mobile-friendly within the next several days. You can reach it at globalmoneytrends.com. And anyone that wants to take a look at the site, you can see some very interesting charts on the world markets, a little bit of commentary. And if you want to see even more, there's a weekly newsletter that I edit and publish every weekend, which is available for a very reasonable amount of money. So globalmoneytrends.com is the website.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Greetings, everybody. John Loeffler here. You know, as a Financial Sense insider, I am sure that you know by now that our weekend program isn't the only news and interview audio available from us right here at FinancialSense.com. We have a weekday program called FS Insider, which features a wide variety of in-depth interviews with key economic experts. And this is available only to subscribers to this service. So what I wanted to do is just take this brief moment to point out that the price for new subscribers to our premium channel will be going up shortly, but that if you're not already a subscriber, you can still get in at the lower subscription rates by going to our website, financialsense.com. You really don't want to miss this opportunity to hear key economic information, news, and views by becoming a subscriber to FS Insider, and do it before the rates go up. And just in case you wonder what you might be missing, here's a selection from one of the Insider programs this week.
China is known for the world's largest government projects. Think of the Great Wall of China, or more recently, the massive spending that has gone into infrastructure to build roads, bridges, and entire ghost cities that many people have yet to even fill. However, many are not aware of an even larger project that China undertook years ago to combat a growing problem that it faces today. Writing for Global Risk Insights, its editor and analyst Jeremy Ludi writes, "Desertification in China is a major problem for Beijing as the country's deserts are growing, threatening environmental, economic, and political stability." Jeremy, give our listeners some background on this very interesting and fascinating story.
Okay, sure. Basically, what the issue is that China, and what we tend to think of China is that it's very, you know, verdant rice paddies and such, but actually a large portion of the country is scrubland and desert. And throughout the whole western and northern part of the country, there are deserts, and these deserts have been growing. And what Beijing tried to do starting in the 1960s was to plant billions and billions of trees to create what has been called the Great Green Wall of China, in order to combat the desert. And by doing this, they were hoping to shore up the soil, prevent further erosion, and also make sure that the desert would stop encroaching on the more viable farmland further south, and also stop raining pollution and sandstorms onto major cities like Beijing, which themselves are only about 2 hours drive from the encroaching desert limits. So it's a major issue for the Chinese government in order to prevent any further increases in the desert size. And as I mentioned earlier, billions of trees were planted, around 60 billion trees, and the idea is to create a sort of fixing barrier to prevent the desert from encroaching. The problem with it is that it was done very sort of single-mindedly and without any type of environmental oversight.
Well, one of the best performing assets of 2016, after languishing for nearly 3.5 years, has been the gold market. Not only is gold up and silver as well, but the gold stocks are leading and up 2 to 3 times as much. Joining us on the program is Frank Holmes from Global Investors. And Frank, just before we went on the air, we were talking about an article in the Wall Street Journal this last week talking about the mining industry losses exceeded the gains of the previous decade. And there's a reason for that, and I wonder if you would explain that to our listeners.
Sure. I'll try my best in this whole process, is that there's two things that your assets, when it comes to having oil and gas or gold, et cetera, in the ground, you have reserves. And those reserves have different, when it comes to gold, they're different grades. And low-grade gold deposits become much more profitable in a higher gold price than a low gold price. So all those low grade deposits that mining companies were writing up because gold hit 1900, now they have to write down and they have to take an impaired charge against them. In addition to having losses of streamlining their business, etc., that's a cash loss. So a lot of these write downs had to do with this full cycle of the commodity impacting the quality of the reserves. And I think that the basic rule that I've understood is that anytime an asset's down for 3 years, you have to take a non-cash charge.
And Frank, let's talk about where the industry finds itself. It reminds me of what the energy industry is going through now. And I can think back in the last decade when we saw the price of gold go from, let's say, $250 an ounce all the way up to $1,900. There was a lot of money that was being raised in the sector. For the first time, you actually had silver-only companies that were devoted to silver deposits. A lot of money was put into exploration. Properties were found. Contrast that to where the industry finds itself today, including the big guys.
I think that a lot of big guys strapped on a lot of debt to develop these projects, and headwinds came. So you had several different, three types of major headwinds. The most significant was the commodities declining. The other headwind was environmentalists showing up in all these countries and ministers that were delaying the process, but you had all this debt and you made all these commitments. And you're spending all this money, but you can't get your cash flow out. And you have to build infrastructure in these remote areas, and you're getting all these delays, but you have to pay your interest. And then you had taxes change for, in many jurisdictions, they increased the royalty taxes, they had VAT taxes. In Mexico, they started taxing the mining industry. Colombia's taxing the mining industry. So you have these three major headwinds, and these corporations had to adapt and adjust. And it's been painful for them.
What about the state of the industry today in terms of cash flow? Can they make money at, let's say, $1,250 gold or, let's say, $16 silver?
That's a great question. So what we have to look at when we look at a gold mining company is the country's domiciled and that's producing the commodity. So one of the best parts that's helped with these rising taxes in Latin America, et cetera, has been the currencies devaluing. And it's been like a perfect storm for several of the miners. And I'll give you some great examples. And that would be Australia. But the perfect storm for Australia is the currency falls 35%. So I'm paying my workers 35% less. They consume a tremendous amount of energy to process and trucks for open pit mines and processing the ore. So the cost of labor drops, but so does the fuel cost drop. And sometimes these are 25% of their cost structure, but they're getting U.S. dollars, even though gold fell 10% last year, their currency fell 25%, 35%. They have a huge margin expansion. And what you've seen in those countries where this has happened, like South Africa, Australia in particular, and to another degree, Canada, some of these gold stocks, like St. Barb in Australia, up 700%. 700. It's not a bear market in stocks. 700. And if you look at this year in South Africa, Harmony reminds me of 2002, where the currency basically halved, the price of oil fell, and gold went up in rand terms. So they had margin expansion, and Harmony this year jumped 100%. That's massive. So that's where one has to take a look at the jurisdiction of where they are. So we have our favorite U.S. mid-cap gold producer. It's doing a phenomenal job in America, but had that company been in Australia, it would have been up 400%.
Now, when you take a look at this and you take a look at some of the majors, what is the state of the junior industry? Because in the last decade, most of the exploration work and the discoveries were done by these startup exploration companies. I mean, the big guys really weren't discovering deposits. So with a lot of these companies now out of the business, or, you know, some of them don't even have any money and they're just shells sitting out there, where's the exploration going to come from?
Well, it's going to have, as these reserves start to decline, the production declines for these gold mining and copper mining companies, they're going to have to go out and acquire someone else who's already had the deposit. So the opportunity is really for the bigger cap mining companies, that they don't have to spend as much money in their own exploration, as the cheapest reserves now are listed. So I think in the next 3 years, a lot of these companies will be snapped up and merged and put out of their misery as mining companies scramble to get new reserves. Even during this halcyon time, when you look at the data points, last year Macquarie did this research of, look, it says 2001, that over $1 trillion was spent in mining. And out of that $1 trillion over a 14-year run, $300 billion was spent in iron ore and $300 billion was in coal. So that's $600 billion. So there's ample supply of coal for making steel and iron ore. But there was only $150 billion spent on coal. copper and $150 billion spent on gold. And there's been no major 3 million ounce high grade gold deposits found. Nothing. So the only way for that growth is to acquire someone else. And what's happening is that the bigger mining companies are scrambling, I think that's most that's behind them, of cleaning up their balance sheet and right-sizing their companies. But they're going to go buy these other companies, especially after they've got through the permit process. And so those companies that are trying to expand have gone to tap the capital markets, in particular royalty companies has been their sort of savior. And the royalty companies came out and saved Glencore. I mean, after Franco-Nevada bought the royalty from Glencore, stock jumped to 80%. Glencore is a big cap stock.
You know, Frank, when you look at this, and a lot of people are still wondering, I mean, if you look at a chart of gold over the last 5 years, it peaked in September of 2011, and it's been a downward step ever since then. During that period of time, we've had rallies in gold, but those rallies have always topped out, and we've had a series of lower highs and lower lows. Given what the charts are looking like today, what are the chances are that this is simply a bear market rally, or this could be the start of something bigger than that? I've had technicians on the program. I've had a few that have said, no, this is a new bull market in gold. We've broken the downtrend in gold that's been in place for 3.5 years, and I have others that are, let's say, more cautious.
I think that the real call is, what do you think of real interest rates? You know, the best time for me as a money manager, where when gold ran from 285 to 300 to 400 to 500, you know, it not hit $1,000 before 2008, and it all took place afterwards. That run is when you had strong global GDP growth. So the demand was greater than the supply. And that was a very different cycle than today. So what we're seeing is copper rally, because China announces, the largest copper producer says they're going to cut their supply by 7%. China's cut back on their steel mills, and therefore they're stockpiling any iron ore, and you're seeing iron ore prices start to rise, and they're starting to create, it's a supply restriction model right now. And so you're always at risk that that spigot gets open, that supply, and if it opens because of strong GDP growth, great. So when I look at the big picture on the world, I would feel much more comfortable when I can get that global PMI the 1 month above the 3 months. The drama to Belgium will destabilize Europe temporarily, but we have to get that PMI 1 month. It was last year for a while, 1 month above the 3 months, but China wasn't. And when we've done our research, if you want to see demand for commodities be a demand cycle, which is a much more healthier, robust cycle, you have to have Japan, America, Europe and China, where their purchasing manufacturers index, which is a great indicator 6 months out, I've written about it extensively, when that 1 month is above the 3 months, it means that all the manufacturers globally are buying commodities to manufacture and they need energy to manufacture. So the future demand for commodities, from metals to oil and gas, starts to turn up. But we've not had that. So there are a lot of technical people are bearish with these spikes, and you get these supply side restrictions, say for copper, etc. They're usually good for 9 months, and we'll see what happens with that. But I think that what's different than from a year ago, when gold had a big rally, I want to back up for gold for your listeners. Gold has a seasonal pattern. It's a beautiful, published it several times a year. The seasonal pattern cycle for gold is very much driven by the love trade, I like to call it. And the bottom happens in the summer, usually at the beginning of Ramadan, because the Middle East buys a lot of gold for gift giving. And then it rallies for the Indian season of weddings and the season of lights, the Diwali season, and then Christmas. And then we have the Chinese New Year is usually the peak. And it has this big surge going into February, Chinese New Year. So with that, it then corrects. And the magnitude of the correction, which we've experienced for 3 years, has been severe, except for this year, because of negative interest rates. So this year, the rates went from positive to negative. So when I look at a government bond, and the U.S. government is going to pay me for a five-year bond, 1.5%, and I take away the inflationary rate of 2%, all of a sudden, that five-year government bond is minus 50 basis points. Gold all of a sudden has a different life to it. So if you're looking at cause, effect, and ramifications, it's so important to look at real interest rates.
And of course, with not only negative interest rates here when you subtract inflation, but actually in large countries like Europe or in Japan, Frank, they actually are negative themselves when you take a look at the fact that if you loan the government money, you have to pay them interest for them to borrow money from you.
You do, and that negative interest rates is always the actually the simplest part of the model. And Kitco's website, they always show you what's driving gold that day. And they'll explain to you it's the dollar. So is a dollar up or down that day as an inverse relationship to the price of gold, which then has another strong relationship with real interest rates. So we calculate this all the time, and we track that as an important trend. And what we're seeing is for the global growth is that its central banks are basically driving down rates to be negative to try to stimulate economic activity, but the global trade of growth is not there because they're taxing it all away, directly or with regulations, and regulations of indirect taxation and tariffs. So we're seeing VAT taxes rising throughout Latin America. When you start seeing the taxes from, say, Obamacare coming through the system, what does that cost for individuals and corporations? It was staged over several years. So it starts to have this sort of a negative traction in the economy, and it moves money from the entrepreneurs of a society into the government workers and where they're redeploying it. And we've seen this probably, you know, the most egregious is Latin America and Brazil with the corruption that's taken place. We have the most efficient system in America. There's always complaints about it, but I can assure you it's much more transparent and people are held to a much greater degree of accountability than they are in many of these other countries which we travel to. So I think that what's important is that, you know, gold is just a key importance in a portfolio. Governments, if you looked at pre-2008, the G20 country finance ministers met on a regular basis. There's always these protests by unions, and you saw it was all about trade, free trade, tariffs dropping. And now, since 2008, it's about synchronized global regulation and taxation, and that slows down the demand part of the cycle. So it will be a change because it can only keep rates negative so long that they have to change their fiscal policies. And I don't know if it's going to happen this year or next year, but it's in a process. It just has to have that swing. And in that interim, whether using negative interest rates, it's so important for investors to have exposure to gold and gold stocks. But I've always advocated 5% in each and rebalance every quarter.
Frank, I want to come back to the industry. Let's say this is indeed the beginning of a new bull market. One of the issues that investors had with gold mining companies in the last bull market was poorly run companies. They over-diluted their shareholders. They overpaid on acquisitions. How would you contrast the state of the industry today and its management?
They can't get money. There's no money. I won't give money. I just see what my friend Marin Katusa is doing in Northern Dynasty. You know, if they want his money and his new board, and they have to stop having lifestyle salaries. There's no lifestyle. So it is, in the transactions we've been doing, is just creating change. And we're bringing on proven mining people on boards, not friends and relatives on these boards with one geologist. And no, there's technically more competent people. So I think the industry is going through, you know, a painful, but it's cathartic, and it'll come out better. And I think you're going to see much more, as I said, in this cycle is M&A work. Even with this rally in gold, the only people to really raise money are big names like Franco-Nevada could go out and tap the markets for $1 billion because everyone trusts their decision-making. And the total board of directors compensation for Franco-Nevada is less than one director at Barrick.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. And their stock has doubled in the past 5 years, and they have $15 million of revenue per employee. Per employee, 15 million. Goldman Sachs is a million. And they don't give out stock options. They're very frugal. They have programs for employees to own stock in the company. They're very shareholder focused. And 6 of the 10 best performing gold stocks last year, they had royalties on. So I think I've always, you know, done your program. My number one stock has been Franco-Nevada because of their disciplines and their returns on capital. And they're the ones that bailed out Glencore.
So, one final question. So, the management was one issue. Governments are a second issue. What's to stop governments, Frank? Let's say we get into another bull market. Gold starts to rise, starts getting up to 1,500, 1,600. Who knows? Maybe even go north of 2,000. What's to stop governments from getting greedy and changing their percentage of take?
There's nothing. There's just nothing. I mean, that's just the reality. There's nothing.
So given that, would an investor be better off with a royalty company and owning bullion versus, let's say, investing in a gold mining stock?
I think that you got to be much more selective. Who is your active manager? Such as, like last year, we're down. We're down 7% over 12 months, but the index is off 24%. You need to have an active gold fund manager. You go by the GDXJ, which everyone trades around, they're off 24% over the past 12 months. And vice versa, rallying this year, they're up 44%, and I'm up 38%. Well, I'd rather be a little less because I'm more cautious in the stocks I pick and to generate those returns. So I think there's some other great active fund managers, and when someone's going to look to buy a gold stock. But if you're going to go and try to pick them yourself, it's very difficult unless you go and pick, I think, the safest bets are the royalty companies like the Basket of Frankel, Silver Wheaton, and Royal Gold.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you do at Global Investors, how could they do so, please?
Well, they go to usfunds.com, and I'd love for them to sign up for our webcast we're doing on tax-free, stress-free income, the power of muni bonds. We'll be talking about our short-term muni, and we're so happy as that is 21 years of positive performance and rising interest rates, falling stock market, and we just believe that in addition to having gold as an asset class, you need something that's short-term, that has the stability of that, so they can sign up for that webcast to better understand this time-tested history of no drama investing. And it's at usfunds.com. Subscribe to the Investor Alert, like investors from 170 countries do. I come out weekly with it, and this Frank talk.
Coming up next on The Big Picture during this holiday weekend, Chris Sheridan interviews William White. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.